You may proceed. We're back on the record in the Snyder case. Mr. Johnson, your next witness is on the stand.
Yes, respondent has called Dr. Wisnitzer.
Yes. Would you raise your right hand, Dr. Wisnitzer? Do you swear or affirm that the evidence you shall give in the case now in hearing should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Doctor, for the record, please state and spell your name.
Max Wisnitzer, W-I-Z-N-I-T-Z-E-R.
And you testified at the CDO hearing, is that correct?
Yes, I did.
So we will not go through your credentials ad nauseum, but if you would just refresh the court's memory as to where you are currently working.
I am working at Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital in Cleveland, Ohio, as a staff neurologist. I am also an associate professor of pediatrics, neurology, and international health at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio.
Okay. And you have a clinical practice, is that correct?
Yes, I do.
And you treat patients that have autism or other ASDs?
Yes, I do.
Approximately what percentage of your practice is dedicated to the treatment of patients with ASDs?
About 25%.
And is that a self-imposed number, or could you treat more ASD patients if you wanted to?
The answer is yes, it is a self-imposed number. And number two, I could easily have a practice made up of 100% ASD children if I wished.
Okay. And the reason that you've limited yourself to 25% is?
There's a demand for my services in other areas, and also because I'm a child neurologist and I want to make sure I maintain my skills in child neurology.
Thank you. Doctor, you've sat through the testimony that petitioners have presented during the trial this week. Is that correct?
Yes, I have.
Did you hear anything that was presented this week that would change your opinion regarding whether the receipt of an MMR vaccination combined with the administration of thimerosal-containing vaccines more likely than not causes any disorder that is on the autistic spectrum?
No, I have not heard anything to change my opinion.
Okay, and just for the record, what is your opinion on that issue?
My opinion is that the vaccines do not cause autism or any ASD disorder.
And the hypothesis that Dr. Kinsborn described yesterday during his testimony, in your opinion, was that essentially the same hypothesis that he described at the CDO hearing?
Yes, it was.
Have you seen any new evidence since you testified in June at the CDO trial that Dr. Kinsborn's hypothesis has gained any new support in the medical community?
No, I have not.
And do you still hold all of the opinions that you expressed on the issue of general causation at the CDO hearing to a reasonable degree of scientific probability?
Yes, I do.
Doctor, then I'd like to turn to the specific facts of the case involving Colton Snyder, the petitioner at issue here. In your opinion, did Colton Snyder's April 23, 1998 MMR vaccination cause him to develop an ASD?
No, it did not.
Okay. Does the evidence in this case support a finding that Colton suffered an encephalopathy as the result of his MMR vaccination?
The evidence does not support that conclusion.
Doctor, have you seen a wild measles infection?
Yes, I have.
So I assume that you know then what the clinical picture of a measles infection looks like.
Yes.
Based on your review of the records, do the records describe symptoms in Colton Snyder that are consistent with the measles infection?
No, they do not.
And I believe that Dr. Kinsborn testified on his cross-examination that he saw evidence that Colton may have experienced some other types of infections following his MMR vaccination. Would you agree with that?
Yes, he did.
Dr. Kinsborn, during his examination yesterday, talked about lethargy as one of the first signs of autism that he noted. Do you agree with Dr. Kinsborn's assessment on the issue of lethargy?
No. May I explain?
Please do.
Dr. Kinsborn represented to the court, and I'm going to paraphrase his words, that in his opinion, the description of lethargy as given over the Memorial Day weekend in 1998, it may have been at least the Monday of Memorial Day and then the following day, the Tuesday, when I think it was when he was when Colton Snyder was actually admitted to the hospital, that there was a description of Colton Snyder being lethargic. And Dr. Kinsborn stated that lethargy could be a misinterpretation of the beginnings of the social withdrawal or the inward interning, as the words that he used, to describe the social behavior of a child with autism. However, the formal definition of lethargy, and I'm quite familiar with it because when reading EEGs, which I do on a weekly basis, that's one of our diagnostic codes that we use within the EEG reading. The formal definition of lethargy is actually an impairment in consciousness. In other words, you're not fully alert and awake. Lethargy means that there's a mild diminution or decrease in your level of consciousness, but you're still able to be aroused, you're still able to be responsive, but if I leave you alone, you go back down to that decreased level of consciousness. By definition, a decreased level of consciousness is not part of the diagnostic criteria of any autistic spectrum disorder. In fact, if there were an impairment in consciousness in the child, we would be looking for alternate diagnoses. Therefore, the use of the word lethargy to define the social behavior of a child with autism is not really the appropriate word to use.
Based on what was going on with Colton at the time, is there, in your mind, a more likely explanation for the cause of his lethargy?
Yes, there is.
And what is that?
The medical records tell us that he clearly had a viral illness. And they also, the medical records also document that he showed clinical evidence of dehydration, the description that was given there. And one of the things we know is that when he was put in the hospital, when he's given IV hydration, he was discharged, he was described as awake. And obviously you can't be awake and lethargic at the same time, which means that at that point there was a significant improvement in his level of consciousness back to the level that you would expect it to be. Otherwise he wouldn't have been discharged from the hospital. And that is inconsistent with the behavior that we would see of the social changes or the social behavior in autism, where once it starts to become clinically evident, it doesn't go away in 2 days.
Doctor, we've already talked about the Weibel article a little bit this morning and how that has been used in support by the petitioners to support the idea that Colton somehow fit the framework that's outlined in the Weibel article. Have you had an opportunity to review the Weibel article?
Yes, I have.
Okay, and can you just describe your understanding of the framework that's set out in the Weibel article?
If you just give me 1 second, as I know I have it in here. But basically the framework that was used was taking information that was reported to the VAIR system, and basically one of the criteria, they looked at features, encephalopathy, ataxia, seizures, then looked at the outcome of the children, but they had exclusionary criteria in that paper. And if you read the methods section, the exclusionary criteria was the authors did not accept a case if there was an alternate explanation for the features that were present at that time. Clearly in Colton Snyder's case, the events that occurred around Memorial Day of 1998, the medical records tell us that there's an alternate explanation. He had an acute viral infection with fever, with pharyngitis, and with dehydration. The doctor, and that basically when it was treated, he improved. This is not an this is not a case that would have been accepted within the criteria as defined in that paper.
Doctor, there have been a number of videos that have been provided by the Snyder family. Have you had an opportunity to review those videos?
Yes, I have.
Okay. And can you just describe, generally for the record, what is on those videos?
What was provided to me was videos of Colton Snyder, and of course, as part of it, we also have other members of his family, starting at age 3 weeks to age 13 months. Then there's a gap in the records. And then the video resumes, the initial portions of the video resume and is described according to the given timeline that was presented with the video, or after the video, but it was given, it was a chronology was finally provided, of autumn 99, and actually some information that was stated to have been from February or March of 1999, and basically running up to about the time of his third birthday.
And did you review all of the videos that were provided by the petitioners?
Yes, I did.
Based on the videos and of course the other materials, the medical records that you've reviewed in this case, do you agree that Colton showed signs of developmental delays?
Yes, I do.
Just tell us generally what your impression from watching the videos was.
From the limited information I have on the video, but it's a recurrent theme. In other words, it's something that doesn't change. What becomes obvious in the video is the decrease in expected language use up to age 13 months. When you basically watch Colton Snyder in action during this time period, either he doesn't make any sounds, he screeches, he makes some nonspecific noises, and he extremely rarely says either ba, ma, or maybe a two-syllable sound like a baba or a mama, but it's not a lot. There's no interpersonal babbling that I can see. In other words, there's plenty of opportunities. His siblings come up to him and talk to him. He doesn't talk back to them in the way a baby would. He doesn't seem to sustain any kind of a language interaction that's there, and what's most impressive to me, one of the points that's impressive to me on the video is that we have the opportunity to have a, we want to think of it as a control, and if I may identify there is a portion of the video when he is 7 months old, where there's another child going around his playpen, basically babbling. And it's not Colton, because when you look at Colton, you watch his mouth, it's not moving. And I played that section back multiple times. But there's another baby who's basically making a lot of baby noises around there. And this is not the behavior that Colton manifests anytime in the video, whether it's at 7 months, whether it's at 11 months, which is at Christmas time, whether it's at 13 months when we're taping him here. He looks at the camera. He plays with the camera lens cover multiple times. He has inconsistent responses to voice. When he's called, sometimes he responds, sometimes he doesn't. And what I take from that, because I also have evidence afterwards of his language that's given to us, and just for people to reference things, and I will reference the points for you. The one at 7 months is basically on what's called Title 6 on the video, and it's part of what's called Chapter 2, if anyone wishes to look at that. But later on, if we're looking at portions of the video, you can look at Title 9, Title 10, Title 11, Title 12, no babbling. Title 13, no babbling. Title 14, no babbling. He does make, during these times, for instance, in Title 12, he makes some nonspecific sounds, but again, there's just no babbling. That just raises a concern to me that there's an underlying problem with language.
And did you see anything in the medical records that that caused you to think that, or that corroborated what you saw in the videos?
Yes, I did.
And tell the court what that was.
Let's just first start by stating that in the regular pediatric care records, in the first year of life, there is a documentation, for instance, at 6 months and at 12 months that the physician does not have any concerns regarding development, but there's no documentation of specifics. And we'll take it at that. Yet later on, when you look at the evaluation, first of all, we look at the evaluation by Dr. Otegbe on June 11th, 1998. He lists in there that the mother gives a history of a three-word vocabulary: mama, dada, and the sister's name. Afterwards, the next documentation we have of language is in November 1998, on November 12, 1998. It says spitting out a few words, but it doesn't say what they are. It doesn't say how they're being used. In the referral to early intervention, they state that he had a 3 to 5 word vocabulary. In the mother's handwritten record of her initial visit to Dr. Bradstreet, that was in 1999, mother documents the use of 5 words, all names, mama, dada, and family member names, and nothing else, and basically states that there was just a speech arrest, that there seems to be a language arrest. Again, telling me that there seems to be this pattern of a pre-existing problem with language. And it almost, it seems to me that the language stagnated somehow in the second year of life and just didn't go anywhere. And this is what you can derive from reviewing the video and looking at the contemporaneous medical records.
Dr. Wisnitzer, have you seen patients that have presented with a similar picture, clinical picture, as Colton Snyder?
Yes, I have.
Okay. Based on your review of the records, when was functional improvement in Colton first documented?
According to the available records, and this is from early intervention, after he starts his speech therapy, the speech therapist documents as early as July 1999 that he's showing improvements in language. And if you go through her notes from that point on, she documents continuing improvement in language skills and in play skills.
Doctor, does it surprise you that Colton improved with speech therapy?
No, it does not.
Why not?
First of all, for children with underlying language problems, whether or not they're related to an autistic spectrum disorder or they're individual by themselves, we know that intervention helps. We know that appropriate intervention helps, and obviously in this case it appears that he had the appropriate intervention in terms of the speech therapy. And we know that we see growth. In other words, there's data telling us that this happens.
And do kids respond either better or worse to speech therapy based on their intelligence or intellectual capabilities?
Well, I thought that the speech therapist gave a wonderful quote, and I'm going to again paraphrase her, that with the appropriate intervention, the children improve to their own intellectual and cognitive abilities. And that is basically the mantra that we try to push, that if you do the appropriate intervention, the children hopefully will get to the point that they were supposed to get to. Obviously, in Colton Snyder, it was very, a very good point that he got to, and I'm glad that he did. But so that it does not surprise me that the growth and gains that were present, that occurred, did occur.
And just so I'm understanding you, are you saying that, that his great improvement is based in part on his excellent intellectual capabilities?
In part is based on his on what he has available to him. In other words, where his cognitive potential is. He clearly had the cognitive potential to be in the normal range. And he showed that, that was there. And that's important, because if cognitively you are destined to have an IQ of 50, you can do all the therapy that you wish, and you're not going to get to an IQ of 125. And while you look in the records, and in the records you can see that there's testing done initially, which shows that he does not have good skills. This is a typical pattern in kids with ASD. First of all, the cognitive testing that was done was limited because of levels of cooperation that were present, so you can't get the best picture in the world. Secondly, all that that testing tells us is where his language is at that point in time, where his function is at that point in time. It does not necessarily tell us where he's going to end up 2, 3, 4 years from now. It tells you where you need to start your intervention. And I think that his situation explains it very well, because we see this good growth in his developmental skills and his language skills from at least July 1999 onward.
And I believe you testified during the CDEO hearing and presented a slide on something that you called the natural history of autism. In your opinion, is Colton's improvement in course consistent with what you described as the natural history of autism?
Yes, it's one of the developmental patterns that we can see, that you are worst, you're worst at the second, beginning of the third year of life, and then you start showing improvement with the intervention, and you grow to your potential.
And doctor, do you treat any patients who you classify as having regressive autism?
Yes, I do.
How many of your patients that have regressive autism improve to the point of being essentially normal?
I don't have any who have done that.
I believe that's all I have. Thank you.
Mr. Powers?
Thank you, Special Master. Good morning, Dr. Wisnitzer.
Good morning, sir.
We have met before. Obviously, we had a colloquy on your direct and my cross during the Cedillo case. And I do want to follow up on maybe a couple of issues that were addressed in Cedillo that were not covered today. But I will primarily focus on your expert report and the direct testimony that you've given here today. I first wanted to talk a little bit about your expert report. Early on in the report, you talk about some identifiable biologic underpinnings. Do you recall that portion of your report?
Can you show it to me where it is, sir? Just tell me where it is.
It's on page 1. It's down at the bottom.
Which report, sir? I have two reports.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's the most recent one. I think it was described as a supplemental report. And that's the one dated September 28, 2007.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So now that we know that the report we're talking about, the page we're talking about, is page 1, and just down there at the bottom, there's a discussion that you have about identifiable biologic underpinnings. Now, you list marker chromosome 15 syndrome, fragile X, tuberous sclerosis, and then certain inborn errors of metabolism. I was just curious what you were referring to by certain inborn errors of metabolism.
The classic one is untreated phenylketonuria, or PKU.
PKU, okay.
That's the classic. There is a representation that some children with mitochondrial disorders also will have an autistic spectrum disorder phenotype. So that's basically two groups.
Okay. Are Are there any others?
There are some others, but whether it's directly linked to the autism or whether it's just because of the severe impairment in cognition that's present, that they also show autistic features, is less well-defined.
Okay. And is the reason that it's less well-defined is that there are other morbidities associated with the condition that are beyond what you would find in ASD?
No. The more retarded you are, the more likely you are to just show autistic features, even if you don't have autism. In other words, if we look at a group of children with severe to profound mental retardation, at least 30 to 40% of them will show some behaviors that people would classify as being within the autistic spectrum.
Okay. Are there any other, I should back up. Are these underpinnings, these biologic underpinnings, are these genetically based, the ones that you list here?
Yes.
So they're pretty much genetically determinative. If one has marker chromosome 15 syndrome, one will be autistic. You'll fall on the ASD spectrum.
No, you may be autistic.
You may be autistic.
Yes, there's more to it than just that, than just having marker chromosome 15.
Okay. But marker chromosome 15 is entirely a genetic issue.
Yes, it is.
For the ones that you list here in this sentence about the disorders that begin with marker chromosome 15 syndrome, are there any environmental contributions that would be a biological underpinning to the presentation of ASD in children with any of those disorders?
The only biologic underpinning in marker chromosome 15 is from which parent you inherit the chromosome.
Right. And same with fragile X is...
No,
the question is there any environmental contribution?
In fragile X, we don't know of any environmental contribution.
PKU and these other inbred errors of metabolism, no environmental contribution?
No.
How about tuberous sclerosis?
Tuberous sclerosis is not truly an environmental contribution. It's really linked more to early onset of seizures, which is not environmental in itself. It's due to the underlying condition.
Yeah, so the seizures are caused by the underlying condition, and the seizures can then create the conditions under which one might be autistic?
Well, it's more complicated than that.
I was afraid it was.
There's an association.
Okay, thank you. That's fine. Now, you also talk about the presence of additional clinical features, certain in utero exposures. You described thalidomide, rubella, or cytomegalovirus. Are there any other in utero exposures that you would identify as a biological underpinning to ASD?
I know there's a few more. I just don't recall what they are off the top of my head.
Aside from what you've listed here in total in this paragraph, are there any other identifiable biological underpinnings?
This is a gigantic list, sir. I just gave examples.
Okay. And that's just what I wanted to get to. This is not necessarily exhaustive. This is illustrative.
Thank you. Yes, that's actually a very good description. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we're agreeing on some of this based on some of the things we didn't agree about in Cedillo, but I do just want to make clear that this is not intended to be exhaustive. It's illustrative.
Yes, sir.
If you added up all of the biological underpinnings, the ones that you have listed, the multitude of ones that are out there, is there a way that you can identify among all children with autism spectrum disorders what percentage of those autism spectrum disorders are caused by this entire constellation of identifiable biological underpinnings?
The number that's proffered nowadays, where you can do testing, where there's testing available in order to identify it, is probably, to give a minimal estimate, 25 to 30%.
And that estimate of 25 to 30%, is that an estimate that you agree with?
Yes, it depends obviously on the child. In other words, if I have a child who comes in with significant cognitive impairment, mental retardation is another term for that, or obvious dysmorphic features, the number is much higher. Yet even in children who don't show those because of advances in technology, we're finding more and more the genetic underpinnings that are identifiable.
And that was actually a question I was going to ask. Has that percentage gone up over time?
Yes, it has.
Okay.
And it's expected to go up even more as some of the identifiable causes from the lab, if you want to say it that way, are transferred into the clinical arena and the testing is made available to the general practitioner.
And so the identified biological underpinnings, this 25% to 30% range, are those essentially genetic contributions to the appearance of autism spectrum disorder?
Yes, and that does not account, for instance, the rare cases of cytomegalovirus, or I don't think we've seen congenital rubella at least I haven't seen it in 2 decades. Outside of things like prenatal viral illness, but if we're talking about pure genetic,
exactly,
yeah, that would probably be a reasonable number at this point in time. The number will go up.
Do you expect that number to reach 100%?
I don't think anything reaches 100%, and let me explain why. That even if we state with certainty that we know that something has a genetic underpinning, it does not mean that we have the technology available to prove the exact genetic disorder, the exact genetic problem.
And when you say underpinning, are you using that in the same sense as the word cause?
Yes.
Okay. So when we're talking about the biological underpinnings to autism spectrum disorders, we're talking about identifiable biological causes.
Yes, sir.
And at this point, it's your testimony that we have identified, I say that as a lawyer, not as a doctor, I should be saying it as a doctor, you all have identified that about 25% to 30% of ASDs can be related to these identifiable causes. And aside from thalidomide, rubella, or cytomegalovirus, they're pretty much all genetic. Is that a fair statement?
Yes. There's probably some in utero exposures that make contributions, but we know the ones such as thalidomide. People talk about the contributions of things like valproate, mm-hmm. Especially in animal models, and with perhaps some human data. There's other data suggesting some associations, but no proven causation at the present time. But I expect that we'll find acquired in utero phenomena that would cause the autism. We just have to wait and see as we get better.
Okay. Do you believe that there are any postnatal environmental contributions to autism spectrum disorder?
Not to cause what we would typically call autism, no. Not by itself, no.
And what do you mean by not by itself?
Well, there is data telling us that there are some epilepsies that present very early on, second year of life, maybe third year of life, that will basically have an autistic phenotype, and that with intervention and with treatment of the epilepsy, you can basically make the autistic phenotype disappear. In my own practice, I have a handful of children for whom we've been able to be successful in this kind of management. I don't know that there's any proven certainty of any postnatal exposure by itself that will cause an autistic spectrum disorder.
Do you believe that there are postnatal environmental exposures that, in the presence of a genetic anomaly, might cause autism spectrum disorder?
Well, let's not use the word anomaly. We'll just say...
What word are you comfortable
with? Well, I think when people talk about this, they say a genetic predisposition or a genetic... difference, whatever terminology you want to use. Let me answer it this way. People have hypothesized this. It is a thought that is actually running through the community now. I am basically neither yes or no. I'm waiting for evidence to give me more information to confirm to me that this hypothesis really has legs.
Mm-hmm. And the hypothesis then is that there may be genetic vulnerabilities or genetic...
Good word.
Or genetic predispositions that in the presence of a certain environmental exposure, can result in ASDs.
That is what people state. I've read a lot of articles, and all it turns out to be is personal opinions with no data. And it's a problem when people do this. I don't know if it's in science whether that's always the right thing to do, that all you want to do is give your personal opinion, and because of your name it carries some weight. I like to see the data. And I think right now there is nothing to support that hypothesis, but I'm open-minded and willing to consider all information. And I would change my opinion if the information would sway me.
And that is actually getting a few questions ahead of me, but that was the question I was going to ask, is that obviously with the IOM and NIEHS and academic institutions, the Mind Institute, etc., looking at this, and I'll just describe it in shorthand, the gene-environment interaction as a cause of autism.
People are looking at that, I agree. And that's why I said I'm waiting for the information.
And you would be open to changing your mind based on data that comes out that's reliable?
Yes.
Okay. But then getting back to where we are today, would it be fair to say, in your opinion, between 70 to 75% of the cases of autism spectrum disorder, in your opinion, don't have an identifiable biological cause? Is that correct?
Let me back it up and say, I gave you the genetics.
Yes.
Okay, I gave you the proven genetic testing and the proven, let's say, in utero exposures that we know about. In addition to that, we also have families. For instance, let me give you examples. I have families where I have two or three children who have an autistic spectrum disorder. There's clearly a genetic predisposition that's ongoing there. I haven't identified it. I don't know what it is, and I can't convince anyone at my medical center to do testing because it's such a small family unit, the chances that you'll find the gene are exceedingly low.
Right.
But the thing is, we know that that's genetic. And there is a group of individuals, probably an additional 5% or so. Some people quote a slightly higher number, I'm being conservative, but an additional 5% that you can add to the other number that I gave you before that clearly fall within that grouping. Then in addition to that, we've got a larger family unit of what's called the broader autism phenotype, where there clearly are the relatives. It might be that there's an idiosyncratic cousin or uncle, where you may not have full-blown features, but enough that we call it the broader autism phenotype, and we know there's an increased risk also of showing further about having children with autism. That would not be surprising because there seems to be something running in that family that seems to be genetically based. And that adds an additional number there, so you can't really say it's the 70 to 80%. You might have to narrow it down perhaps to more like 50% or so where we have no identifiable reason at the present time.
And then even in some of these family studies, and I know in Cedillo the issue of the twin studies was discussed. It was primarily by Dr. Fombone, and I believe addressed those studies. But even given high concordance rates of ASDs within sets of identical twins in particular, that concordance rate didn't get to 100%, correct?
Correct.
So that even where you have identical twins, there are presentations from the published literature for one twin has autism spectrum disorder and the other identical twin does not.
Yeah, there's a very small number, I agree. I think the number that's given is about 10% of that cohort. But from a science standpoint, the idea that you have 90% are concordant is a very strong evidence of the genetic predisposition.
Certainly, and the predisposition, and I appreciate we can continue to use the same terminology here because that number does change as one might expect with fraternal twins. The concordance rate drops, and you have pairs where the number of ASDs and the number of non-ASDs diverges some. And you would expect that if you're looking at a genetic contribution, correct?
Yes, sir.
And when I say expect that, I mean the difference between the concordance rates between identical and non-identical twins. You would expect that.
Yes, sir.
But at this point, there's no identifiable biological cause of autism, and we'll take the numbers that you've now added up, and I've tried to keep track of somewhere in a range of 50%.
Let's just use that number, yes.
Okay, and I'm comfortable using that number, and it sounds like you are. So in half the cases of autism spectrum disorder, right now you're not able to say what the cause of the autism spectrum disorder is. Is that a fair statement?
If you're asking that I can give the specific reason, outside of saying we have evidence telling us that it's most, you know, most likely prenatally based slash genetic slash something wrong with the chromosomes.
That's what I mean by genetic.
No, I would state that the twin studies tell us that the vast majority of those kids probably have something wrong with the chromosomes, in other words, with the genome, that we have not yet identified. But if you're asking me, have we identified the reason, the answer is no.
And that's what I'm asking.
That's a better way of answering your question.
Yeah. Now, any of these biological causes that we've discussed so far, and I know it's turned into a fairly long list taking off from what you had in your report, are any of these biological causes or any other biological causes known to be associated in particular with regressive autism?
The tuberous sclerosis kids are. The epilepsy children are. The mitochondrial disorders are.
Any others? And because I don't want to cut you off, it looks as if you're still considering that question.
There's others. I can't give you them off the top of my head.
And collectively, with those known biological causes related to regressive autism, do you have an idea of what percentage of regressive autism cases could be tied to one of these known biological causes?
We don't have good numbers, no.
Have people looked at that issue?
They've looked, but the problem is it's a biased sample. It's not like you're looking at a population. There are papers out there saying there's a large number of them that are mitochondrial. If you look, you'll find a mitochondrial disorder that's present. But again, it's a biased sample because they may have been referred to a center because they specialize in mitochondrial disorders.
Right.
I don't know of any good population survey that's actually addressed your question.
So, and just to be cautious then, would it be fair to say that based on a lack of data, you cannot answer the question of what percentage of regressive cases are caused by these known biological agents?
Yes.
Okay.
And one more thing, because I think we need to add there, is also how people define regressive autism. Whether they're using the stricter, I think we had a discussion about this last time.
We had a long discussion about this last time.
Whether they're using the stricter criteria of totally normal development with a clear defined loss of things like functional language and things of that nature, or whether they're basing it on someone coming in and just reporting it without checking the specifics of it.
Okay.
And there are papers out there where they actually state, we didn't check. We're listing it because that's what we were told it was. That data has to be taken for what it's worth.
Right. Now, you also in your report, and this I'm just flipping to page 2 of the same report, sort of moving on to a different issue here. At the very, very beginning, the statement is that between 1/4 and 1/3 of children with ASD, a history of autistic regression is elicited. Is that a history that's elicited by a treating physician? I'm just trying to figure out where that number is.
That's experience? No, that's what people have written. My experience, I think, is more like 15% to 20%.
Okay.
This is what people write in the literature. And I think you notice that the history is elicited, but the last sentence of that paragraph says, in retrospective evaluation, clinicians frequently identify developmental abnormalities occurring before the frank appearance of apparent regression.
Right, and that's why I was asking about the history being elicited, because I contrasted to that sentence and they seemed to...
But it's just the history of someone saying that there was an obvious regression.
Right. Now, in the case of Colton Snyder, you described some evidence that you identified as signs of developmental delay. And when I was listening to your testimony and taking the notes that I could, it sounded as if it was all related to language use. Is that correct?
Yes, that's all I really had a good sample of on the video. And therefore, that's all I could really comment on. And That's the information that's most apparent in the contemporaneous medical records about language.
Right. And now, if I recall, there are three different domains that one assesses in diagnosing autism spectrum disorder. Language is one of those, correct?
Yes. Communication is a better word.
Yeah, well, because I do want to use your language. What are the three domains that you could that you would identify as the diagnostic criteria for autism spectrum?
Significant qualitative impairment in socialization, significant qualitative impairment in communication, and restricted interests / repetitive behaviors.
Now, in your review of the videos and of the medical records, you've already identified what you believe were some communication or language developmental delays. Is that correct?
There were clearly problems with language. I agree with you. Yes.
And in the social domain, there's nothing in the medical record and nothing in the video that would indicate a deficit or delay in social skills.
There's not enough to answer that question. There's some soft information about some subtle differences in social behavior, but nothing concrete, nothing severe. We'll just say they're subtle. And if I may, I mean, I'll even identify time periods that you can go back and look at the video.
Yeah, well, actually, hold that thought for just a second, because I have some follow-up, so I am going to ask you to do that.
And let me answer your third one. Your third one is there's the restricted interest repetitive behavior.
No, I haven't asked that question. Yeah, that was your domain, but not yet my question.
Okay, sir.
In the social domain, you're going to give us some references that you see as subtle, but my question was, there's nothing in the medical record, there's nothing in the parent's testimony or caregiver's testimony to give rise to social deficits in Colton before the age of 15 months.
There's no comment in the medical record one way or the other, and the testimony that was given by the parent and by the mother, by his mother and his aunt, did not identify that. I agree.
Yeah. And in fact, the testimony of his aunt and his mother indicated that, in fact, he was very socially interactive, had social skills, play skills with other children, relational affinity towards relatives and friends. You remember all of that testimony, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Now we will, if you could just go ahead and just list the areas where you see that there might be some subtle issue with social issues.
Let us just start. Title VII, which is when he's 11 months old, at about 1 minute into the video, he's called many times, doesn't respond much to being called.
And how long does that sequence last?
According to my note, probably less than 30 seconds.
Okay. Other spots?
On Title VIII, I have a note, but I don't say when it is, that when his name is called, he doesn't turn.
Excuse me, how old would he be at that point?
13 months old. And at 13 months old, on Title IX, it's written that there's not much of a response to a hug. On Title X, does not specifically look, has to be prompted to do certain to do looking behaviors. Now, in that, he goes to his father in there to give credit, but there's no sounds that are made. On Title XI, there's no response.
I was unclear about what the issue was there. You said he's going to his father, so he's being social, but there's a communication issue?
No. There's evidence of some differences in social behavior, but there's also evidence of social behavior.
Okay.
I just know, just to give credit where credit is due. On Title XI, there's no response to voice. On Title XIII, he ignores his siblings. And that's all I think we have that I have of a sample. That to me is all subtle, and I'm just pointing out that it's there, and I'm not saying anything more than just that those behaviors are there.
And it would be fairly common, wouldn't it, for a completely neurotypical 13-month-old to occasionally ignore his parents when they call his name. Isn't that correct?
I agree. But the problem, and if it was just once or twice that I saw it on there, I wouldn't give it any credence. But the thing was, I saw patterns of behavior.
And these patterns are a couple of seconds at a time, 30 seconds at a time?
No longer, yes.
Okay. You've already described the language, or excuse me, communication issues. Let's talk about the repetitive behavior. Anything in the medical record to indicate stereotypical behavior or repetitive behaviors that would be associated with ASDs?
I assume you're saying at what time? Time period? I
mean, before his MMR.
Okay, sir. Because there's comments after, you know, in terms of Dr. Bradstreet's notes, but there's not really explanations of what they are. There's no documentation of the specifics. It just says has some self-stim behaviors and nothing more.
Right, but you did hear testimony about repetitive play behavior from family and
but caregivers. That's play behavior. It's interesting. That's a play behavior. That's an aberrant play behavior. That was there. But there was nothing before that I could basically hang my hat on.
Right. So those are the three domains, and we're going to move on a little bit to talk about some other issues that came up in your direct. For the language issues that you described, or the communication issues, particularly by the age of 13 months, I think you used a decrease in expected language use. At the age of 13 months,
there was no language use. There were no words. There were some syllables that you can count on one hand, the number of times that you could document them, despite interactions with multiple individuals in the interactions by multiple individuals in the environment. So there was just nothing.
And that's based on your review of the videos.
Yes, sir.
You were here for the testimony of Colton's family members.
Yes.
And I assume you heard that the parent report of word use by 15 months was between 15 and 20 words. Do you recall that testimony?
Yes, sir.
Word use of vocabulary of between 15 and 20 words by the age of 13 months.
15 months.
By 15 months, yeah, because we're talking about your deal with the video was 13 months.
Yes, sir.
By 15 months, 15 to 20 words, is that in the range of appropriate vocalization?
If the words are used for functional purposes, the answer is yes.
And as you sit here today, you don't know one way or the other whether they were used functionally as you would just describe it.
Assuming that history is accurate, yeah, then I don't know.
And so what you then see is the use of two or three words at 13 months.
Excuse me?
So you see the use of two or three words at age 13 months.
I saw no words. I heard some syllables, a ba, a ma, and a baba. That's basically, if you play back the video and watch it, mm-hmm. and you're welcome to do so, sir.
Oh, I see.
You'll notice there's no real syllabic babbling, or polysyllabic or multisyllabic babbling, such as I would expect from a child of that age.
So the child at the age of 13 months then, 2 months later, is being described as having between 15 and 20 words.
It's interesting. The description is the description we heard in the courtroom in 2007. The description is not what's documented in the medical records in 1998.
You then went on to talk about the lack of words, at this point, 2 to 3 words in language arrest that were noted in the reports of Dr. Otegbe and his developmental referral and then by Dr. Bradstreet's initial intake.
Well, Dr. Otegbe did not state anything about language arrest, sir. Dr. Otegbe just basically documented a 3-word vocabulary, and this would have been at age 17 months.
And this would have been after the administration of the MMR.
Yes, sir. And more importantly, Dr. Otegbe did not document any history that was given of a loss of language.
And now the fact fact that he didn't write it down, the lack of any note of his is not dispositive as to whether it had actually occurred or not.
And while I would agree that one note would be telling, but when you look at the note from the week before, from the nursing admission to the hospital when he was admitted on May 26th, there's no documentation in the nursing admission of any loss of language either.
And he was going to Dr. Otegbe for the possibility of juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. Is that one of the bases for the referral?
Yes, sir.
So it's conceivable that on intake they were not asking questions related to the entire history of this child's communication and language history.
I was impressed that he actually took a history of development. And I think that at that time there would be an opportunity that if there was a concern about a loss of skills, it would have been articulated.
But again, the fact that it's not in there, you can't say here right now one way or the other whether it happened or not.
The fact that it's not in there basically just says it's not in there. That's all.
Okay. And then with the referral to early intervention, there's the referral to language, the lack of language and language delay. That also was post-MMR, correct?
Yes, sir.
And very obviously, Dr. Bradstreet's records and the mom's notes that are contained in those records, that would all be after the MMR.
Yes, but let me just do one thing, sir. It was after the MMR.
Okay. Now, you talked about briefly the speech therapy that he had with a professional language therapist, and we heard her testify. Your testimony was that he showed improvement in the language during the course of and by the conclusion of his speech therapy. Is that a fair statement of what your testimony was?
Yes, sir.
Now, this improvement, the course of this improvement also saw the implementation of a special diet, the GFCF diet, gluten-free, casein-free diet. That's correct, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
That interval in which his language improved post-treatment included the IVIG administration by Dr. Bradstreet, correct?
Let me make sure I have your question correct. You're saying that during the time period that we were already seeing improvement in language, during that time period, in other words, from the time period of July 1999 onwards until speech therapy was actually stopped, during that time period, IVIG was started in March of 2000. The answer is yes.
Yeah. And there was a course of IVIG treatment that was given simultaneous with a significant period of his speech therapy, correct?
There was a course of, yes, yeah. Yes, with a significant time period during which he received speech therapy. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
There was also a program of nutritional supplements that Dr. Bradstreet was recommending to the family that Colton was using. That was ongoing during the time that he was undergoing speech therapy and showing an improvement, correct?
Yes.
And the improvement also followed after the administration of secretin by Dr. Bradstreet.
The improvement was temporally associated with giving secretin, yes, it was.
Do you also, and I should make clear, were you here for the testimony of the speech therapist?
Yes.
Okay. You also do recall that the speech therapist reported that Colton's progress was very unusual and quite striking. Do you recall that?
I don't remember those exact words, but if you'll represent it to me that way, yeah. I'll believe that.
Yeah, and I'll be careful, and I won't say those were necessarily her exact words, but do you recall that the tone of her testimony was that Colton made unusual and fairly dramatic progress during the time that she was taking care of him. Not taking care of him, but working with him.
May I change the wording? That she was impressed by the amount of improvement that he made. Is that a better way of saying it?
Sort of says the same thing, but I'm fine with that.
And especially when she represented to us with the small number of individuals with autism for whom she was actually providing services at that time, it would not surprise me that she would make that kind of a statement.
Yeah. In your expert report, sort of jumping back and forth, but I'll try to track this as closely as I can, on page 2, further down, there's a paragraph right above the section that's entitled measles as a cause, et cetera.
This is, again, the 2007?
Yeah, that's the only, and just so you know, Doctor, if it makes it easier to move among the documents you've got on the stand, the only report I'll be referring to is the 2007.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
So that's Respondent's Exhibit Y.
Yes, thank you, Special Master. And it's page 2 of Respondent's Exhibit Y that I'm going to refer to. In that paragraph, it lists a number of treatments that you've identified that Dr. Bradstreet administered to Colton Snyder. You see the paragraph I'm referring to?
One more time, tell me which
paragraph. Yeah, sorry. It is 1, 2, 3, full paragraph number 4.
Oh, I see. Right above measles.
Yes, right above measles.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. I thought you meant right below measles. Yes, I see it, sir.
Okay. Now, you listed the treatments and then described that they have not been shown to successfully treat the central nervous system manifestation of measles virus persistence, on and on. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'll get in trouble from the Special Master if I start reading entire sections of a report out loud. But I want to focus on that issue for just a moment. I want to ask a question that rephrases that a little bit. Have any of these treatments been shown to successfully improve the symptoms of children with autism spectrum disorder?
Which symptoms?
Any symptoms. I'll keep it broad and let you...
talking about the core symptoms or just the behavior?
What distinction is there between core and behavior symptoms then?
I'm glad you asked me. May I now answer your question? And it's part of your answer. Seriously, it's part of your answer. And let me say it this way, by proffering the concept which is not unique and given, that children with autistic spectrum disorders are allowed to have other problems. I think everyone would agree. They're allowed to get a cold that's not caused by the autism. They're allowed to have allergies that are not caused by the autism. They're allowed to have food intolerances that are not related to the autism. And you can keep going on and on. They're allowed to break their arm, and it's not necessarily due to the autism. And I think we have that situation in this case also, or later on. Getting put on the gluten and casein-free diet and reporting that there's improvements in behavior does not mean that there's a cause-effect relationship between the gluten and casein-free diet and the autism. In my hundreds of patients in my practice who've been on the diet, the only parents who've reported improvements are those in whom the children appear to have a problem with milk or a problem with a gluten product. And would not surprise me, 1 in 250 to 1 in 500 children are gluten intolerant. They have celiac disease. There's a much larger percentage. In fact, I would wager that if I go through a room here, I'll find at least a few people who are lactose intolerant. I'll find a few people here who've had milk allergy when they were younger. And Colton Snyder clearly had problems with milk. That's well documented in the medical records. And what struck me in the medical record was mom stopped his Nutramigen at age 18 months, gets put back on milk, his behavior deteriorates. Take him off the milk, we see improvements in behavior, better responses to speech therapy and such. It is not saying that the gluten and casein-free diet is treating the autism. The gluten and a more practical interpretation there is the gluten and casein-free diet is treating a food intolerance / allergy that was pre-existing and was aggravating his behavior and making him miserable, but he wasn't able to articulate what was going on with him. I have seen this over and over and over again. Now, to get more specifically to your kind of a question, there's clear-cut data that Secretan doesn't work. There are NIH-funded studies. The NIH spent over $1 million funding several studies, double-blind, placebo-controlled studies, that show that Secretan had no impact on autism. There are other articles in the literature that Secretan had no impact on autism. Unpublished work that we did at our medical center, where basically we gave it and then asked for documentation from individuals who didn't know that the children had gotten the treatment. We were unable to verify this significant improvement in autism that has been claimed with Secretan. But I think the most telling information for Secretan was that the parent of one of the children, if I'm not mistaken, one of the children that Dr. Horvath originally reported, actually got the patent rights to Secretan, formed a company called Repligen, did phase 3 studies, which is what the FDA mandates you're going to do before you would bring a treatment on the market, a medical treatment on the market, and these phase 3 studies failed to show any improvement in the autism in the population, and I haven't heard a peep from that area since
then. And certainly in that study, it wasn't that every single subject in the study showed no improvement.
Oh, no.
It's right. So I just want to make clear what you're saying. You're saying that in the studies that have dealt with secretin, those studies have not found that. What is it? I mean, because in some of these studies, some of the kids did show improvements.
But the question there is, again, going back to why did they show improvement? They may have some underlying problem. You know, there's two possible reasons. One is it could be a placebo effect. If you look at Levy's work out of Philadelphia, she actually documented the placebo effect that Secretin engendered in the population. But she went back and interviewed the parents about this later on. We also saw a placebo effect within the work that we did. Parents wanted to see the improvement and they saw it, or the child was showing improvements from the natural history of the disorder. We're talking about the autism that was ascribed to a treatment that was done temporally at the same time. Now, I'm not talking about at all about maybe Secretin doing something for your bowel, or if you have some diarrheal illness and Secretin doing, I'm talking about treating actually the autism itself.
And then, which then brings me back to this definition of core symptoms. So the core symptoms of autism would be those symptoms that give rise to a diagnostic conclusion across one of those three domains.
Yes, sir.
So it would be your testimony that none of the treatments that are listed here that you describe have any effect on the core symptoms.
None. And if I also may state, for chelation therapy, there is no data one way or the other to state whether it does or doesn't do anything. And number two, there's not a good biologic model to support that the issue of heavy metal, quotation marks, poisoning or elevated heavy metals in the blood have a causal relationship to autism. When it comes to the issue of IVIG, there's no good data to support its use. There's just no good data. The studies that have been done have significant flaws within them from a study design standpoint, that it's very difficult to take that information and extrapolate it and say, see, it does have an effect on the core features of autism, which is why this Canadian group that I think Dr. Zwyman mentioned earlier basically came to the conclusion that they made the recommendation that it seems to have no effect. The American Academy of Pediatrics basically has stated that there's no data to say whether it does or doesn't work, because the work that's been done, the research work that's been published, is inadequate to support the conclusion that it does work.
So there, in some of these cases, there is research data that's been published, but you're saying that you don't think it establishes efficacy.
I'm not the only one who says it, sir.
I understand.
Large groups of people who say it.
I understand.
I'm just basically quoting what those individuals say. And again, it gets down to the bottom line. When you do these kinds of treatments, and I think a very telling example of this is the issue of nutritional supplements. There was a case report in the New England Journal of Medicine.
And is this a report that's in the record?
No, I'm just saying this is an anecdote, unless you don't want me to say it.
Let's stick to the questions that I'm asking. I mean, you sort of had the opportunity to wind up and go forth on direct, but I just want to focus on some questions that I want to ask you that are specific. On page 3 of your expert report, Respondents Exhibit Y, if you look at the paragraph started number 2, early in that paragraph you say that Colton Snyder did not show any evidence of inflammation, including any neuroimaging. Do you see the line that I'm talking about?
Yes.
Now, Colton Snyder did have an MRI done in 2006. Do you recall seeing that in the medical records?
Yes, sir.
And there's nothing in the medical records of any neuroimaging that was done on Colton Snyder before then, correct?
Correct.
So the fact that there's no evidence of inflammation on neuroimaging, there's no imaging to rely on. So whether there was evidence there or not, we just don't know because there's no imaging done.
At contemporaneous, if you're saying at what time, 1999?
Any time before January 2006.
There is no imaging done, sir.
Right. Skipping pretty much further ahead in your report on page 4, there's a partial paragraph at the top of the page. It talks about prenatal viral exposure as a potential cause of ASD, but there is poor support for postnatal causation. I just wanted to make clear that in that sentence you're talking about specifically postnatal causation on viral exposure.
Yes.
It's not a more general statement about other postnatal exposures.
Correct.
Okay. And excuse me, Special Master?
Yes.
I still have a fair number of questions to go. And I don't know if we necessarily need to take the lunch break right now, but could we perhaps take even just a 10-minute?
Well, if we're going to take a break, why don't we take the lunch break if it's now afternoon?
I think I have at least a probably good 30 minutes.
We're on point to have 3 witnesses today. Do you anticipate that we're going to have problems getting your third witness in if we recess from now until... my watch to behave now until about 10 after 1?
I will answer that question no, but condition that upon the fact that the Vince is going to be doing it, Mr. Madnowski is going to be doing the questioning, and he's not here. But I believe that should not be a problem.
Okay. Why don't we do the lunch break now rather than take another rest break?
I appreciate that, Special Master. So you're saying 1:10?
1:10.
Thank you.